This podcast is presented by the Prince George's County Memorial Library System.
Hi, I'm Kelsey.
I'm Heather.
And this is our podcast, These Books Made Me. Today, we're going to be talking about From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler by E.L. Konigsberg. Friendly warning as always, this podcast contains spoilers. If you don't yet know what kind of beer might have crushed up the velvet underneath the statue, proceed with caution. We have a special guest this week. Could you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Audrey Maynard. Come find me at the newly reopened Hyattsville branch.
Woohoo!
I wanted to find out from everybody what this book means to you. Was this everyone's first time reading the book? If not, how did this reread compare to your memories of reading it when you were younger? And I can really start off by saying that Mrs. K read this aloud to us in fifth grade. It had only been published a few years before that, and before now, I had only reread a portion. From this story, I got excited about the idea of going behind the velvet ropes at a museum and breaking some rules, but not behaving too irresponsibly.
Yeah, I read this book when I was a kid as well. I think I was probably like third or maybe fourth grade. I don't remember exactly. One of the things I do remember, though, was we had this thing called Accelerated Reader at our school. And you go on the computer and you would say, I read this book. And then you would have to take a little quiz about the book and you get points.
Yeah.
And then you could go buy something at the school store. That was what we got. I was always like, I bought a pencil. I bought candy.
What?
But I read it for Accelerated Reader because it got good points back then for like my grade and what level it thought it was. So that was the first time I read it. And I loved it when I read it as a kid. And then I think I read it. I loved my reread this time around, too. I had forgotten like how quality the writing is in it. Mm-hmm. It's really well done.
Yeah, this was one of my favorite books as a kid. One of the ones that I reread over and over and over again. I haven't read it in a long, long, long time. And it was interesting because the thing I remember most as a kid is like getting this like really like haunted, like magical vibe from the museum and just this idea of like being stuck in the museum. Like the setting really stuck with me as a kid. As an adult, I really felt drawn to Claudia as a character and like how like kind of obnoxious, but in the best possible way she is. I think I connected with Claudia as a kid, but I don't think that how precocious she was really stood out to me the way it did kind of reading back. So yeah, I love this reread and I'm really excited to talk about it today.
Same. Let's talk a little bit about the plot first, just to refresh it for everyone. 12-year-old Claudia Kincaid feels bored, unappreciated, and a true sense of righteous indignation at the injustice of it all. She decides to strike out on a grand adventure and chooses her younger brother, Jamie, as her partner in crime. They run away and take up secret residence at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Claudia is entranced by a statue of an angel that may or may not have been sculpted by Michelangelo that the Met has purchased from a reclusive donor for the low, low price of $225. The siblings immediately decide that they have to solve the mystery of the statue's origins, conducting their own research in the museum and in the library. Their detective work eventually leads them to the door of the statue's reclusive former owner, Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, a wealthy widow with her own secrets, and the narrator of our story. Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler finds kindred spirits in the two precocious children and eventually trades Claudia the secret of Angel for the details of the children's week at the Met. The children also find a kinship with Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler and become surrogate grandchildren to her, fulfilling her impossible wish to experience maternal love.
And now for a little background on the author. So Elaine Lobel, or E.L. Konigsberg, the only author to have ever won a Newbery Medal and an honorable mention in the same year, and one of only six people to earn two Newbery Medals, was born in New York City in 1930. Her parents, two Jewish immigrants, moved the family to Pennsylvania soon after her birth, and she went on to graduate from what is now Carnegie Mellon University with a degree in chemistry. She began but never finished a graduate degree in the field, leaving the program when her husband, David Konigsberg, earned his Doctor of Psychology and moved the family to Florida. She taught science at a girls' school until the birth of her first child in 1955. After the second child, she picked up painting at an adult education school, and after the third, when the family moved to Port Chester, New York, she took up writing. According to Publishers Weekly, she chose to go by E.L., partially to obscure her gender, and partially in homage to the author E.B. White. From the Mixed-Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, her second novel, won the Newbery in 1968, the same year her first novel, Jennifer, Hecate, Macbeth, William McKinley, and me, Elizabeth, was an honorable mention. 29 years later, in 1996, her novel, The View from Saturday, won another Newbery. In between the two books, she wrote more than a dozen others, known for their wit, outlandish yet relatable scenarios, usually 12-year-old protagonists, and intellectual heft, uncharacteristic of many other children's books of the time. She died in 2013 of complications from a stroke. In her obituary, the New York Times referred to her as an unabashed information pusher, which is absolutely how I, too, would want to be remembered. Explaining her chosen genre, they quote her as saying, "Children's books are the key to the accumulated wisdom, wit, gossip, truth, myth, history, philosophy, and recipes for salting potatoes during the past 6,000 years of civilization."
All right, so let's dive in. How did this book hold up?
I mean, I think the biggest thing we always think about is like, well, there's two big things. Obviously, stereotypes. I didn't see a lot of that in here, but like dated things. So this book came out in 1967. And for me, the biggest thing I was marveling over is how cheap everything was. I was like, you can get to the city from Connecticut for $1. You can get lunch at the Met for $1.25. You know, that was pretty exciting and sad, considering how we're dealing with inflation right now. I think that stands out to me a little bit as something that comes across a little dated now.
And the automat, one of the places where they go, which I always thought was the neatest thing. And I think they were already on their way out by the 1970s when we were in school.
What is an automat?
Where you put your money in and a drawer sort of opens and you take your piece of pie out. And
it's like a vending machine for real food.
But so
which
they sort
I think
of,
we should call our vending cafes automats and just see if it catches on.
And I guess what they did is they filled them from the other side and then you would get them out. But I remember, I don't know if our class did, but we were, a lot of us were sort of fascinated and wanted to go see one of the last of the automats. And I think they made the news when they finally went out of business, that kind of thing. So.
Oh, that's sad.
I think also we were talking about how prices tend to date things in some ways. But that being said, I don't think that the book is particularly dated. Okay, you get that like things were cheaper then, but there's enough context with the money. She really digs into how much various things cost. So you have a sense of the economy of the time. So I think it's not all that off-putting. And the rest of it, it's taking place in the Met, which is full of all sorts of objects from antiquity and different time periods. And is kind of timeless in its own way because the Met's still just the Met. The one thing that I felt like I kind of cringed about, and this is not like a bad thing. It was more of a like, oh, the Met. The Met was free, right? And so there's a whole section in the book where she talks about how everyone can go to the Met. You get people from Kansas. You get people from just walking in off the street. You get people from France. And the Met in our lifetimes has started requesting a donation.
Yep.
When you visit. And that was very, I don't know, controversial at the time when they rolled that out because it had been such a bastion of you too can come to this place and see these great things from the great civilizations of the world and you can experience these things. And it was supposed to be like a leveler of sorts. And now that they've kind of swung to the like, well, you don't technically have to pay, but we strongly suggest you pay something to come in here has really changed the tone of the Met.
You have to go up to the counter and like actively be like, no, I am choosing not to give you money. Thank you. You can't just like walk in.
Right. Which like if a child of this age now has gone to the Met recently, they would have a very different experience. I guess like the Smithsonian's, though, are kind of similar. Now, like you really can just walk in if you're a kid there.
Yeah, I was thinking like that's the experience at all the museums in D.C. pretty much.
In the Washington, D.C. area, few exceptions, at least the federally run museums mm-hmm. are free, where in other states and other countries, people are accustomed to pay.
Right.
So this quasi donation halfway measure, some other people are like, well, this is about what I would expect to pay somewhere and be fine with it. But yes, anytime something had been free, and part of the point was that everybody could experience it no matter what their income level is. It does make a big difference.
Yeah.
I did like that the public library is still very much as it is in the book. The kids go there, they get a librarian to help them locate resources for their quest to figure out who the sculptor of the statue is. You could still do that today. There would be nothing weird about that at all for two kids of that age to go unaccompanied to a library and ask a librarian for help. So
yeah,
I think that's cool.
I was going to say, I think your point about the cost being really well explained and like put in context is a really good one, because I think that is the difference between it being an old book that you still connect with and a book that feels dated in a way that's not accessible. There were two things that I feel like one is the public typewriter that's in front of the building. That very obviously was like, this is an old book. But also when they're getting changed after they spend their first night in the really fancy 1600s bed, she puts on a petticoat, which I didn't know was a thing in the 60s. And I was really confused.
Kind of like a slip you might wear under a dress to make it hang.
Yeah, I think petticoats have remained a thing for like nice dresses.
Yeah, but I would call it a slip. And I would think back then that's what they would call it too. But I guess apparently not.
A petticoat tends to have some volume to it and it makes your skirt lie a certain way, like to go to church.
And it might sort of be fluffy, so then it made your skirt poof out a little bit.
But we also call them crinolines, too. I don't know if you call it that. Petticoat to me is very like, that's more like Petticoat Junction. Like, it's got like a very different like vibe to it or something, but like crinolines, but it's the same idea. Like,
I think I just like automatically associate the word petticoat with the 1800s. Clearly, that's an incorrect connection.
American Girls series would have had.
That's probably why.
Petticoat thing. Yeah.
But yeah, I think now they're a lot more anachronistic than they would have been at the time. Because like certainly for fancy dress, I don't know. Did you wear church dresses that you had a petticoat in it or like it seemed attached? Like,
and we probably did call them like a slip or a half slip that we referred to, but definitely was something under it so that it was sort of lay right. Not necessarily poof out, but lay right.
I need that now.
And I agree with you about something about the money. Because I kept going back and forth and Jamie was the keeper of the money, it was more like working out what things cost, which you still might do today, even if your budget was 100 or 200. Right. You're like, I have this amount I can spend for lunch, and we have to take the bus, so I can't get a slice of pie. So that was all sort of in the context of what they were trying to do.
Yeah, fountains are a less good source of income now because of inflation. Unless we bring back like dollar coins, like everyone starts carrying them. Fountains are not a good source of sustainable revenue. Those pennies aren't buying you much. Let's talk a little bit about why this book resonated for us as readers and whether we think it would still resonate today. I have to say for me, it felt very fresh. Like reading it as an adult, it felt very fresh. I think the opening chapter is one of the like great descriptions of ennui that I've ever read. You feel it in your bones. Yes, it is a very like privileged white girl version of ennui that Claudia has with all of her perceived injustice. But everyone's felt that before, that like there's got to be something more than this feeling. And I think especially like when you're a girl and you're having all of these sort of societal expectations that are very gendered put on you. She really rankles it. Why do I have to do the chores and my brothers don't? Why do I have to be the one that's like responsible and my brothers don't?
Yeah.
You feel that and you get irritated by it. It says she was bored with simply being straight A's Claudia Kincaid. That feeling is so relevant for maybe any person, but for girls that are achievers.
Yeah.
Every precocious girl has felt that. That you've been distilled down into, you're a smart girl. And that it's this little box you've been put into. And you're like, but there has to be more than this because my life is not exciting. I'm doing all these right things, but there's no excitement. I'm bored and I hate this.
We're just arguing over who picks the TV on the 7:30 channel every day.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
Breaking out of a routine that's been set up, whether you helped to set that up because you achieved all of these other things. But then where are the things that are sort of sideways things that are not that, that are different? You might be afraid to tackle something that you would fail at, but what other things are there that you could experience?
Well, and what satisfaction are you getting from your achievements? Because at this age, okay, the A's are easy, right? Mm-hmm. So you know there's something more. And she's a reader, right? Like she's described as just reading everything, which also like totally resonated for me. Yeah. Like I read everything. If it had words, I read it. It was the Merck manual. It was the DSM that my dad had because he was a psychologist. It was
shampoo bottles.
Exactly. Like I read anything with words on it. And Claudia is much the same. She's in with the like AAA travel guides and maps and stuff. And she's she's dreaming about these things. She's internalized all of these like female greats. I think Jamie at one point says, you're trying to be Joan of Arc and Florence Nightingale instead of Nightingale. But like the point's well taken. She's living in her head a lot, right? She's comparing her life to all of these things that she's read and these people who are doing great things and exciting things and big things. And she's like, this can't be all there is. It's just me here going to school, doing this routine, arguing with my family. And
yeah.
Yeah.
100%. I was the oldest girl in my family. I definitely think I resonated with all of the like the injustice of all the responsibilities and the pressure put on me and the, you know, I'm achieving, but to what end? I think absolutely all those things. I also think that Yael Konigsberg does a really good job capturing like the drama of the 12-year-old mind, like even just the harping on the word, like the injustice of it all. Like as a kid, you're like, yeah, things are unjust. This is not fair. As an adult, you're reading and you're like, this is hilarious. Like you can see like the how she's kind of like lovingly making fun of her in a way, right?
Right. She's upset about they only have a cleaning lady twice a week and her friends have like live-in housekeepers. That's catastrophic to her.
Yeah.
But it would be unknown to her, the idea that nobody had any help in her group or her bubble, where certainly plenty of people, parents were the help and went out and did that for somebody. And all the kids had to pitch in and do all of the kinds of things. But since it was alien to her experience, she just didn't pay attention to it.
Yeah. When I was doing research for her bio, one of the articles said that like Yael Konigsberg said that she said that she came up with the idea for the story because she had an indoor picnic at the house with her kids and they were like very unimpressed and unenthused. And she said like basically their standards were so high. The only place they could ever run away to was the Met Gallery because their expectations and their standard of living was too high. They were like too rich for the blood of a picnic.
I mean, she has no real struggle here. Yeah. The struggle is boredom. The struggle is expectations. It's not any kind of, we don't have the drama that we've seen in some of our other books where like food is tight because money is tight, or they're experiencing racism, or they're experiencing being in a new country and not knowing the language. There's no struggle on that level, but she feels like she's in the struggle, you know, like the struggle's as real as
who
you experience
am I?
It, I guess.
What do I want to be? What does the future hold? I can't tell.
Yeah, it's an existential crisis on some level, right? The point is taken that she has definitely a bubble. She's very sheltered. But at the same time, she has some self-awareness of that because there's that great line about like, she says like living in the suburbs had taught her that everything has a cost.
Yes.
Which I think jaded. Is also like one of the great descriptors of suburbs ever. There's times where she kind of bursts into tears because she gets overwhelmed and she's aware that she's, oh gosh, I'm kind of overreacting to this, but like the feeling is still there. The feeling is very real for her, which I think is really, again, relatable at that age. Like everything does feel so heightened and so intense and like your hormones are not, everything feels heavy.
Yeah.
So like, yes, as an adult, I think you look at it and it's like, wow, she doesn't really have all that much to deal with. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of funny. But at the same time, like, I think it's a really true depiction of how you feel as a tween.
Yeah.
Especially a tween oldest daughter.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that connects is just like the fun of having a conspiracy, the plotting. Like, I love the idea of like, and I'm sure as a kid connected with the idea of like, it's just really fun to plan something and like do the research and have all your pieces in a row. And then when she's like, she gets Jamie to like sit with her on the bus and they're like, I got a secret, you know, like she's very like strategical about it in a way that's like really fun. And you just like enjoying the fun of the adventure with her.
She had figured out everything to do with the school bus yard and where it went and when he was going to stop and how long they should wait and then wait a little bit longer. I thought, she is really getting some detail here.
Where to hide his trumpet and his bedroll. So
yeah, she planned it very well. Yeah. I mean, credit to Claudia. This was a well-executed plan on every level.
Yeah. And like the level of detail she put into like which brother she would take.
Yeah.
Jamie's the miser.
Well, and she also knew how to like hook him in too. Like she knew she was going to have to make it appeal to him in some way. So it was like, okay, I'm going to pitch it as an adventure and I'm going to flatter him. And then he'll be all in on this. And he was.
I like the idea of complications.
Yep. Yeah.
There certainly were some.
I love that.
He when likes she's... dirt and complications was the description of Jamie, I think.
She says, like, she admits that he's been, like, cheating his friend in the their game at of war. Which, first of all, I really want to know his secret. How do you cheat at war? It's like... it seems impossible to me. But the fact that he like is cheating his friend, and then she's like, how could you cheat your friend? That seems terrible. He's like, I sure don't know. I guess I really like complications.
No, I think Jamie's a great character as well. And yeah. Like, I obviously Claudia very much hit home for me, but so did some of the Jamie stuff too, because I was a terrible miser with my money. And I could have told you at any point, like down to the cent, how much money I had and where I had hidden it. And I thought about money a lot. And so I feel like that would resonate for another kid. His liking dirt and complications also might resonate for a lot of kids. Because, yeah, there's real fun in that. You know, there's fun in an adventure. There's fun in just kind of winging things as you go. Mm-hmm. And that they play off of each other so well is really nice, too. Like, they still bicker. Mm-hmm. You know, they're siblings of that age gap, they're going to fight. But I think it's a very true like sibling relationship where mm-hmm. it's like, oh, having a co-conspirator really brings you together with somebody.
Yeah.
Teamwork when needed, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have another book that has AWOL parents in it. Now, this time, the parents didn't remove themselves from the situation. The kids removed themselves from the parents. But do we want to talk a little bit about this book and sort of where it fits in the long lines of parentless kid trope?
I mean, we've talked about it before that, like, as a kid, I think you read this and you don't ever think like, oh, where are the parents and what are they doing? But as an adult, the whole time I couldn't help being like, their parents must be freaking out. Yeah. Like, they must be so stressed. And it almost made it a little hard for me to read because I was like so worried for them. Like, their kids have been missing for more than a week.
They really are not seen at all. I mean, they should. No. Everything that she talks about, she references them very briefly and mentions something about, oh, I wonder what my mom's thinking. Oh, she's freaking out.
Yeah, they tell her like your mother must be frantic. She's Jamie asks her something about like, what do you, or maybe it's Miss Frankweiler asks her about like, what did you think about, like, what do you think your mother is doing? Well, to be honest, it hasn't really even
She's like, I sent her
me.
A letter.
Like, I told her not to worry.
Sent her a letter, which you sent like right away. Yeah. And it's just been like a week since then. So it was just in some of these, it's, you can tell on some books that like that the parents are this sort of unseen kind of thing, or they precipitate something that gets the kid out of the house, and that they were just sort of absent. And even at the end where you might have seen this reunion, it's just, you know, you have the testimony of the chauffeur taking the kids home. They didn't put the privacy window back up so that all of that stuff can be reported, and we never see them reunite with the parents.
So yeah.
It does make it interesting that the book comes full circle with the lawyer Saxenberg being their grandfather. At the beginning of the book, when Miss Frankweiler is first writing to Saxenberg, she says something about like, you'd almost be interested if you weren't so like hung up on this and your grandchildren. And then at the end, when we find out, oh, that's because his grandchildren have been missing this whole time. It's like,
what a twist.
Miss Frankweiler really is the old lady version of Claudia. She didn't care what they were feeling either.
You know, I was thinking too, I guess two things. Like, one, I think thinking back to when this was written, kids did have a lot more independence back then. And I think that makes a lot of this book possible in a way that it wouldn't be as possible today. Like, they're just not as, they just were not as like surveilled and tracked as I think kids are now. It is like kind of interesting to think about how this book would be received now compared to at the time it was written.
The level of autonomy the kids have in the book. Okay, you could still go to the public library. You could still technically go to the Met as a kid unaccompanied, but like going to buy a post office box, I feel like, would probably set off a lot of like red flags for people today. And that's part of sort of helicopter parenting. It's also part of like, we're constantly tracked. A kid who's 12 is going to have a cell phone, right? You'd have much better ways to track the kid than they did, where they're getting mail from her sporadically. And that would be a whole nother twist to the story. Like, she'd have to get rid of the cell phone so that they couldn't be tracked. Kids did have a lot more autonomy, and I think a lot more was put on kids at that age because certain things were considered to be safer. So it wasn't all that weird for kids to go and possibly rent a P.O. box. Maybe they were doing it for their parent. You know, it wasn't as weird to see young children like grocery shopping. You know, they're able to sort of fly under the radar and avoid detection by just piggybacking on like school groups and stuff. But they really don't have to do that much to avoid detection because they don't stand out that much.
Right. And for them to go and eat breakfast or lunch of, you know, 12 and 9 or that's not. And then Jamie had that big elaborate thing about how the boiler had exploded. Yeah. I was like, that was, wow, that was really good. And he said, yeah, I came up with that one. I'm so glad. So glad to get a chance to use it.
Which I thought was really funny because I would think Claudia would be mad at him that he came up with something so easily fact checked. But she was like so proud of him for having that story ready to go.
Yeah, the going to the restaurant is really interesting because that's something that I did with my friends when I was Claudia's age. Like when we were in middle school, I would bike to my friend's house and then there were like four or five of us and we would bike into town and go to the Chili's because we were real high end and we'd order the endless chips and a drink each, which sorry to the Chili's waitresses because we were the worst people ever now in retrospect, but we didn't know because we were like 11 or 12. No one ever was like, where are your parents or why are you here at this restaurant unaccompanied? And I think now people might be, where are your grownups? It just, that's a big cultural shift.
I used to go off of school or off of some after school thing, and I'd go to a place to get a hot dog and a drink while I waited for my mom to get off of her part-time job, and no one ever would have said a word to me, and I certainly was no more than about 12, so.
Right.
So let's talk about Claudia a little bit more. Claudia is clearly our heroine of this story. Is she a role model? Should we be asking the Harriet question? Is she a sociopath?
No.
I think Claudia is a much more sympathetic character personally than Harriet, because Harriet was just straight up mean on purpose. Claudia is more solipsistic at times, but I don't think it's ever pointedly cruel. It's more just she's forgotten her mom exists.
Yeah, I mean, she's goal-oriented. She changes her goals when she achieves one. She and is ready to bargain with Mrs. Frankweiler to get the information that she needs. Yeah, I think she's a role model. Jamie is a role model, I guess, too.
And they take care of each other, which I also think is a nice sibling relationship and something good to aspire to, getting along with your sibling well enough that you could be on the lam for a week together and have each other's backs like that.
Yeah, that's extremely alien to me. Neither of my brothers and I would not have happened.
So like as someone who was at that time and still to this day is kind of known as an obnoxious know-it-all, you know, it's nice to have a nice obnoxious know-it-all character I could connect with, I think. But I do think you see her grow and like really kind of reflect on, you know, why she did what she did, what it means to like be a kid in the world. Like that's some pretty deep stuff. And I think it's important to have a kid ask those big questions in a book and like trust that your tween readers will be interested in that and want to read about that. And like, I loved when she was talking about how their fiscal week starts on Wednesday.
Yes, that was fantastic.
She's very responsible. She's going to allow Jamie to escape the tyranny of shoes. I love her. She has a lot of good like one-liners, but I think it's nice to see a kid being kind of responsible and uptight. She's allowed to be that, you know, and that's okay. I'm a little iffy about like glorifying running away from your house. So that's maybe not the most role model-y thing, but
I don't think it portrays it as a total lark. It shows us a little bit of why she got to that point, that she felt that that was a decision to make. And within her mind, sending the letter, going somewhere kind of safe and controlled, like a museum.
Right.
Yeah, I think also she was able to put aside some of her impulses and instincts to be a good member of the team. Like she did not go splurge on the taxi cabs or the hot fudge sundae. She deferred to Jamie. She delegated well and said, okay, I know this is not my strength, so I will defer to you on the issues with the money and the budget, which I think is a good thing for kids to see teamwork.
A sense of fairness, too, because it was mostly Jamie's money.
It was his money.
And he had to authorize everything. And I think that struck me more on this reread than I, in listening to it be read aloud so many years ago that, mm-hmm. that yes, it was hit. So, you know, they each had their role to play and they deferred to each other and worked together.
Mm-hmm. She also learns kind of how to be a person in the world. Like the, if you correct someone's grammar every time they talk, they're probably not going to want to talk to you anymore. And so I need to learn like how to like have civil, respectful, like I can still love grammar, right? I can still like appreciate good language, but not have to like be condescending every time I talk to my brother. That's like a moment of growth for her, I think, at the end of the book.
It's an interesting moment of growth for her at the end when she sort of realizes what it is she needs for herself. There's a real sense of her sort of moving from being a child to like a young woman at the end of the book when she's able to have this thing that's internalized and it's only hers, but that's going to kind of keep her going because mm-hmm. it's internalized and it's only hers. And it's not this like outward thing, which mm-hmm. was part of what she was trying to run away from, is like, my whole identity are these outward things, these roles that people put on me. So she has her secret about the sketch and about the statue mm-hmm. and that'll all live inside her. And that's enough to like keep her going in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something very sophisticated about that idea in a children's book, that bit of like knowing yourself and knowing what a thing says about you and being okay with that just being something that you hold and are motivated by, mm-hmm. I think is an interesting take for a kid's book.
And figuring out who to kind of let in and trust, because she really wants to like make this adventure, like she wants a tight control over it. Like she's planned everything, every piece is to her liking. She doesn't want to give up any information unless she absolutely has to. And she kind of learns that in order to get what she needs, she does have to put a little faith in Mrs. Frankweiler to be that resource that she needs to help her get there. She wouldn't have had that internal peace if she hadn't let someone else in.
Here were two of the lines that I liked referencing what you're both saying, both towards the end and when she's met Mrs. Frankweiler. Mrs. Frankweiler has given her some insight into Claudia by telling us, secrets are the kind of adventures she needs. Secrets are safe. And they do much to make you different on the inside where it counts. This is Frankweiler kind of counseling her on that, about the type of adventure you can have and the meaning that those secrets can have. Because Claudia is saying, well, if nobody knows about it, what good will that be? How wonderful that will be. And then I really love this line so much, almost towards the very end. Happiness is excitement that has found a settling down place. But there is always a little corner that keeps flapping around. And it's just lovely to think of that.
The book's really full of these very pithy quotes. It's really well written. I would like to talk a little bit more about the writing style of the book, because I think it is pretty unique for the time. And I think it stands out in children's literature. There's so many moments, like the quotes that is when Miss Frankweiler is saying the adventure is over, everything gets over, and nothing is ever enough. There's all of these things that just perfectly encapsulate a vibe or a feeling. Like, I think that's part of why the book resonates so well, is that even as an adult, you read some of these things and it's like, oh, I feel that one in my bones. You feel it. Like, it's really, really well wrought. We were talking about it being an epistolary style, which really was not common for children's mm-hmm. literature at the time. And now it's extraordinarily common. Like, it's a very common device that's used. But I was looking back, think that makes the book really interesting. It feels more grown up.
When I was reading, I wrote down that it's the most exciting book about probate law I've ever read.
Nice.
But yeah, I've always loved epistolary style novels, and I wonder if part of it came from this. I do think it's interesting because you can kind of forget that it's epistolary, because she really only writes in like true letter form, like to Saxenburg at the beginning and the end. The middle kind of turns more into a story, and you kind of forget until you have those little kind of asides like, Saxenburg, I must explain to you the restaurant at the cafe because I know mm-hmm. you're too dull to understand, or something, you know?
Yeah. And I think I had forgotten that was really how it was framed, because mm-hmm. In my mind, the story unspooled and Claudia told us some and Jamie told us some. And I get to the end, I'm like, oh, that's right. They're kind of like saying all of this into the tape recorder. So then I guess I had forgotten it. And some epistolary novels now have, you know, multiple letters back and forth. And that's part of the story that you've got each person writing to each other, or maybe there's a third person involved, where this one really extends, you know, pretty much the old way. It has the asides to remind you of it, but not insistently every couple seconds. It doesn't talk to you the way Lemony Snicket will break the wall and talk to you and or say, dear reader, or things like that.
Yeah. As someone who really loved Lemony Snicket's work, I feel like this probably primed me well for that as a reader.
I was thinking how much The Westing Game owes to this book, and we'll tackle The Westing Game at another date.
Soon.
But yeah, and I think that it owes a lot to this book as well, but it really does feel like this book was doing something new as a children's book. There's also the like letters within the letters, essentially, because you have Claudia's letter to the Met, and then the Met's letter back, and then they're so like... just dejected. And Claudia's like, it's just way worse to get a polite rejection letter than if like they had been rude and I could just be mad about that. It hurts more when they're nice about it. And that's really true too.
But at least they bother. I looked at that. At least they bothered to explain.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you get this kind of thing and they're like, no, we know all about it.
I guess. But like, don't you also see it from the point of like, if you apply for a job and then they send you this like, we're sorry, you were a great candidate, but we've decided on somebody else. We're sorry to not be able to offer it to you. That hurts a lot worse than like if they never call you back or something. You're like, well, I wouldn't have wanted to work there anyway.
Yeah. It's back like 100%.
Or I think that some people say it's even worse when they tell you why they didn't pick you right. And why they picked someone else. So that's kind of, I guess, the feeling that she got with this letter back.
Well, and you can imagine she probably feels a little stupid, right? Like they were like, oh, we uncovered this great secret. And the Met's kind of like, yeah, we knew that already.
Well, it's interesting, too, that she and Jamie have such like opposite reactions. Like Jamie's like, this is cool. They treat us like adults. And they wrote this letter back and look, we did all these things that the grown-ups are doing. And Claudia is very much like, no, they're just telling us we're not special. The polarity of their responses to that are a really nice illustration of their personalities.
The other quote that I saw from Konigsberg is she said that the reason she writes 12-year-olds is this idea that you both want to be in your very core, like special and unique, and also want to be the same as everyone else. And her kind of like mission as a writer is to like explore the distance between those two ideas and how you reconcile them in one person. And I think you see that so much in Claudia, as we've already kind of talked about.
This one also, we talked a little bit in our prep about the Death by Newbery trope, which I don't know if somebody wants to explain that, but this one does not fall into that trap. Nobody dies in this book. No animals die in this book. There's not really any tragedy in this book at all. They have a very successful adventure.
And no villains.
No, there's no bad guys. It's just two kids that go on this madcap adventure and live in the Met for a week. More or less a happy ending for everyone. I guess we don't see what happens when they get home. I'm sure that family's going to need like really intensive therapy after this because...
Well, it's funny because you could flip the story and it could be about like, what's her brother's name? Sam and Kevin like dealing with their siblings being missing. And then that would be like prime Death by Newbery content, right? But we're just seeing the other side of the story.
Yeah.
I thought Death by Newbery, I thought it was like saying that when you get a Newbery Award, people don't want to read your book anymore. Because I know there's like a thing where a lot of people are like, don't agree with the Newbery Medal or don't feel that it selects.
I think there's been real validity to the idea that Newberys often are books that adults like for kids, but they are not books that kids like. So yeah, I think that exists too. I don't know if there's a name for that.
I feel that way about Prince Award for
every
teen books.
Every book a reader,
Midwinter's Blood.
If it's going to win a medal, like the most prestigious award that we have in our field, like one of the most prestigious awards we have in our field, like you want it to be like life-changing book. The way to pick a life-changing book is to have something life-changing happen in the book, right? Like that's not true, but that's like the mindset. So I think it is cool that a book that like where really nothing of significance happens and it's like kind of funny and like it's not of grand consequence in the grander scheme of their lives.
It's not a tragedy.
Yeah.
I mean, so many of the books that win Newberries are about tragedy or struggle. And there's, like we said, there's not really a lot of struggle in this. Yeah. Claudia perceives a struggle for herself and her struggle is real, but it's nothing horrible. You know, she's fighting ennui, not fighting racism or a terminal illness or the death of a parent. Like none of these things that are typical Newbery bait are present in this one, which is refreshing.
It's like the universal struggle of being a teen that Simple Plan talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a kid. Life is a nightmare. So Claudia says in the book, they have an advantage that most people don't have to solve the mystery, which is they live with the statue. And when you live with someone, you get to know them. Like that's the best way to get to know someone, which I think is a very funny way of thinking about it. So I guess it is the idea of the museum as a place to kind of just casually be versus it being created as built up as this like learning experience and kind of the different way they're able to see the museum when they sleep in the bed or take baths in the fountain or they want to hug the statue. Like, how is this a different lens of like looking at and understanding what it means to appreciate art and history, I think is interesting.
That is interesting, especially because it does run alongside. Though this one bothered me a little bit. So Jamie's class comes to the Met on a field trip while they're there. It seems like he should have mentioned that. Like,
he probably should have known.
Claude, we were going to come to the Met anyways this week. There's my class.
Jamie is not the kind of kid who thinks ahead on his schedule.
No, like he clearly didn't with this one. But it is interesting you have the classmates' experience of standing in line and they're making fun of the one girl and saying she looks like the Pharaoh. And then the other kid's like punching the other one. Their experience on their field trip is very different than the experience that Claudia and Jamie are having, where it's this idea that the structured thing that the school takes you on, you don't really get that much out of. It's just, oh, it's different than a school day. But then the two kids, when left to their own devices to just explore and be hands-on, they went and did like high-level research at the library with like, they were like little art historians. They learned about like the maker's mark on the sculptures that Michelangelo had done. They learned all of these things about Renaissance art that they would not have gotten at all just from going on the field trip, where the things that they would have remembered, Sarah looks like a pharaoh.
Right.
And Reuben did this thing.
Well, and kind of interestingly, I think a theme that emerges is this idea of like pivoting from knowing something just to know it versus knowing something because it matters to you and it connects with your life in some way or it has true meaning to you. Like Claudia's idea is that they will go through the museum every day and they will learn something new. And by the end of their stay, they will have known everything there is to know about the Met, which, you know, Mrs. Frankweiler says like that is not possible. But Claudia doesn't know that yet. But then they get to the library and she's like, okay, I've realized this is not possible. Now I'll know everything there is to know about Michelangelo and the statue. And when they get to the end of the book, she's explaining her strategy to Mrs. Frankweiler and saying like, oh, we wanted to learn something new every day. And Mrs. Frankweiler says, I mean, you too. I don't have to learn something new every day because that's not what adds value to my life. That's not what creates meaning in my life. As a precocious 12-year-old who has been defined by being smart and knowing things, that's a really important thing to hear is like, you are not defined by how many things you know or how much knowledge you acquire.
Well, and that it's not a competition.
Yeah.
I think that's the other thing is Ms. Frankweiler says something about like you need to sit with the things that you've learned and let them take up space inside you and fill up the space. So like that you really need to process things. You really need to be with the things that you're acquiring. She's like that with her collections as well, mm-hmm. that it can't just be this like, I know 83 facts about Michelangelo kind of thing. She's telling Claudia, don't be straight A's Claudia anymore, like, because that wasn't giving you any kind of satisfaction. Instead, you need to be Claudia that lives in this thing that you've learned, that really gets meaning out of it and lets that sort of inform your life in some way.
Right. Most of our books seem to touch on Halloween in some capacity and things that are not great about Halloween. This one may be where they originated the idea that candy is poisoned on Halloween.
Oh, yes.
So Claudia says they find a chocolate bar on the ground and Claudia says that the chocolate bar is either poisoned or filled with marijuana because someone wants to make them into dope fiends. So they buy their product. And Jamie's like, it's okay. And he eats it
anyways. I feel like there's so many arguments for don't eat the half-eaten street chocolate that aren't someone's trying to get you hooked on drugs.
I mean, yeah. I think he was, his argument, it was like an unopened package, but somehow she was like thinking somebody's going to do a tiny little thin needle.
Oh, yeah. It's always the syringe.
Poison in it, some little syringe. Of...
or they vacuum sealed it after they rubbed
they
it in
dope. It full of dope.
Oh, one thing we didn't talk about is this a feminist book?
I would say that it is. Doesn't really discuss traditional roles, but it's clear that Claudia feels that initially. It's not that she's just the oldest that she has to go around and clean up. Her brothers, even when they're old enough and capable to be set to do certain chores, aren't. There's certainly the testimony from Mrs. Frankweiler in multiple ways that says that, look, I'm not a typical woman and I refuse to be in a mold. You know, I will break out of any mold. I would say yes.
Yeah. I mean, you've got the two main women are confident. They're taking charge of their life. They're making decisions. They're, you know, asserting their independence. They're really pushing back against the boxes that are being put on them or around them or however you would employ that metaphor. So, yeah, I think even if they weren't commenting on some of the social stuff, like you spoke to, Audrey, I think just in general, I think they are feminist characters. They are whole people who are flawed and imperfect, but have a lot of really great qualities to them that kind of push back against some stereotypes, especially in the 60s when this was written.
Yeah, there's a really great Twitter thread online that maybe we can link in the blog, yeah. Where somebody proposes that Claudia Kincaid is an icon of 20th century queer feminism. He keys in on this idea of she's refusing to live the life she's been assigned. Like she's really trying to figure out, what do I need? What is this for me? And she picks herself. She says, I'm done with all of these things other people want me to be doing. I can't take it anymore. I'm going to go live at the Met. And then Miss Frankweiler, I think, is the adult version of a Claudia. Like, yes, she's a little eccentric, but she's lived a very fulfilling life. And you get the sense that at 82, she's quite satisfied with the way things have worked out. And that's been sort of a rejection of the things that other people want. Other people want to come into her house and see all of these things that she has. And she's like, no, they're for me. She only lets the kids in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a strong sense of feminism here.
And even a little bit of discussion of like beauty standards and how you should or could look. And Mrs. Frankweiler's rejected all of it.
Yes. That scene is great.
When she brings the mirror, she's like, Jamie comments on her appearance and she makes her.
Well, he says
her
so
butler.
She's like, I don't look that bad, do I? Or something. And he's like, oh, no, I'm not scared of you. I've seen a lot worse looking.
Yeah,
things.
That's it. And she like makes them all just like, I just picture them like quietly sitting there while they like wait for the mirror. And then she gets the mirror and they're all just quietly sitting there and just like how awkward that must have been for them and how like totally undisturbed she is by like pausing the whole situation just to like look at herself in the mirror.
But again, that is very like, it's very much Claudia.
Yeah.
Because Claudia pauses everyone's dinner and everything in this stranger's house because she's like, I really want to take a bath in that cool bathtub. Yeah. And she just does it. She takes like an hour long bath.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's this very like knowing yourself and being okay in yourself. And you know, people just deal with it.
And serving a macaroni and cheese casserole, yes, with a French thing for lunch.
Fromage,
that's fine.
Casserole.
I like she's like, I like macaroni and cheese. We're having it. Yep. Claudia's like, well, all right. Each episode, our luminous literarian Hawa will provide miscellany and insights from our book. It's time for Hawa's Headspace.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Hawa's Headspace, the part of the podcast where I literally say whatever comes to mind. So I know in the book from the mixed up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, siblings Claudia and Jamie run away to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. If I made the decision to run away to the last museum that I visited, I would end up at the Planet Word Museum in Washington, D.C. In their words, the Planet Word Museum is the only museum in the country dedicated to renewing and inspiring a love of words and language. Compared to a lot of the Smithsonian museums in the area, it's not that big, so I'd probably get caught pretty easily. They have a spoken words exhibit where people follow the prompts on individual tablets to try their hand at speaking different languages, which causes the large LED globe in the room to light up. That's where I'd hide, because not only is the globe big enough for me to hide in without anyone noticing, but there's constantly people speaking, so I wouldn't have to worry about trying to not make noise. Well, folks, there you have it. Tune in next time to see what else is going on in this head of mine.
Now let's talk to someone who actually knows something about one of the main topics covered in this book, the Newbery Award.
Hi, everyone. I'm Pam Hamlin, and I'm the Family Literacy Specialist with the Prince George's County Memorial Library System.
And in addition to that role, you are a former Newbery Committee member. Can you tell us about the Newbery Medal is?
Each year, the Association for Library Services to Children, which is part of the American Library Association, gives an award to the most distinguished contribution to children's literature.
How did you get involved with this?
Well, originally I had volunteered, said I was interested in being on the Caldecott Medal, which is the picture book. Then the president of ALSC, ALSC, asked if I wanted to be on the Newbery because they wanted someone with an early childhood background. So sometimes you're sort of nominated by the president of ALSC and other times you're voted in.
Yeah, sometimes it can be really intense. I know sometimes people campaign to get on. So it's kind of funny that you had this, you had a side way in.
Yeah, it was nice. I wouldn't have campaigned.
Yeah. So tell us about what was your experience like being on the committee? What are some of the requirements and like, how did you manage that?
I had a really good experience on the committee. I've heard that sometimes committees can be quite intense and sometimes not as fun. I had a great group. You're required to read hundreds of books over the year and take notes on them and be prepared to sort of push forward the ones you think have more merit than others and be prepared to write, you know, a little summary, sort of defending the criteria. And reread books and defend them, sort of, you're like defending them when we finally got together for in-person deliberations about why you thought this book warranted the award.
I remember when you were in the midst of this, you would tell me about how like boxes of books would just show up at your front door and pile up around your house. How did you get yourself to stay on top of reading as much as you had to be part of the committee? How'd you pace that out?
First, I sort of put everything in alphabetical order in these boxes. And I just set aside a time to read every night, every day, like 8 o'clock. I knew 8 o'clock on would be my reading time.
Yeah. And I think I remember you telling me that like sometimes you'd know pretty soon on if this was or wasn't going to be a good fit to kind of giving yourself permission to keep going or move on.
You know, I wanted to read as much as possible at first so that I could sort of see what met the criteria, what was good. And then as time went on, you sort of know, okay, well, this is a good book, but it's not up there sort of with the top ones that I've been looking at. So, and sometimes you didn't want to put them down, but then you had to realize there was time involved. So it was hard to pick and choose. And sometimes you didn't, maybe a book someone had put forward as a good read and you didn't like it. So sometimes you have to put it down and then pick it back up because the ones that other people were suggesting, we all really wanted to make sure we had all read those.
Yeah. What were some of the most important criteria for the book that you selected?
Okay. So I can tell you what the criteria are.
Yeah. Or I'm curious, like what your priorities were, like what you felt like were most important to look out for, or what most books didn't have that the one that you ended up picking, like really made it stand out, you know?
I guess the plot and the character development, also appropriateness for that age group, which is basically birth to 14. To me, the plot was very important. And just making sure I read it through the eyes of a child and not as an adult me.
Right.
Which was easy because I love kids' books anyway, so.
Yeah. Do you have any particular memories that stand out from that time or any stories of your experience being on the committee?
I remember some people being very passionate to the point of tears sometimes about books, which was new to me. I just had a great group of people. It was a great diverse group of people as far as background, whether they were public or private or school or academic librarians or professors. And just hearing the different perspectives, because some of them I would have never thought about. So that was really cool. And just sort of made friends. We still try to meet each other at different ALAs and we send each other emails. I don't know. I just had a really good experience just exposed to so many different books. I tell you, I learned more that year about all different things than I could say I learned in certain years of school and just the people.
That's yeah. awesome. So can you tell us which book you ended up selecting with your committee? And if you could please relay the story of how you let the author know she won.
Okay. So we had one winner, and it was Mercy Suarez Changes Gears by Meg Medina. And we had two honor books, The Night Diary by Vera Haranandani. And we also had The Book of Boy. That was the other honor book by Catherine Gilbert Murdoch. And so you get to call them, and it was very awesome. But you call them really early in the morning. So we were trying to call Meg Medina, and no one answers. So it's like 6:30, I think. It might have even been, maybe not, because we were on the West Coast when we were calling. But it was still early in the morning on a Monday. And we called like two or three times, no answer. And she finally picked up and said she didn't think she was going to win. And I guess sometimes they called in the evenings and she hadn't heard anything. So she had gone either walking or to the gym or something and had come back in. And she broke down crying and we all were crying. And it was just a really neat experience. Yeah.
Love that.
We were worried a little bit, like, how are we going to contact her?
Got to let her know before it's like public national news.
Right.
Would you ever do it again?
I said if I did it again, I would do it after I retired because it was a lot of time and you want to give it the time it deserves. But I sort of don't want to do it because I had such a good experience and I'm wondering if I get another group and it just isn't the same. I don't want it tainted. So right now I think I would do another award that wasn't so intense, but I definitely recommend people trying to get on it because it was great.
Yeah. Anything else you want to share?
Try to read some of the Newbery books if you haven't. There's some great ones, especially the last couple of years. I always try to read them now.
Do you have a favorite?
I read How to Trap a Tiger, which was, I think, last year. But yeah, I'm always trying to read them now. I may not have read them. I remember picking them when I was a kid because I saw the sticker. And sometimes they were green, sometimes they weren't. But I try to read all the new ones now.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, for our game segment today, I took a page out of the book where Mrs. Frankweiler donates the statue for $225 to the Met, and they think they've potentially found this great deal and bargain because maybe it's by Michelangelo. I'm going to have you look at some images that I found, and we'll have a miniature auction between the two of you. Some of these items are great and worth a great deal of money. Some of them are more like garage sale items and not worth a great deal of money. So at the end of the game, we'll see who has come out best in terms of their auction purchases. Each of you has $1,000 to spend.
Okay.
Our game is called Bargain Hunters, a speculative art and antiquities auction game.
Wow.
So
trademark pending.
Yes. Our first item is a painting of a rich lady of unknown provenance. Would anybody give me $100 for this painting of a rich lady?
I'll give you $100.
$100 to Audrey.
$101.
$101 to Kelsey. This could be a long game if we're going in $1 increments.
$125.
This feels like a scam.
$125 to Audrey. Audrey wins the painting of a rich lady. Let me
I
note
feel like
that
you put
down.
Rich in the title to make us think it's expensive. I've been watching a lot of Survivor and they always do a gambling game every season. And yeah. I've learned you can't blow your money early.
No, but unless it's peanut butter, you need to go all in on peanut butter.
Yeah, but it's
usually
undercover.
So we have Boston Red Stockings baseball cards, which are signed, some baseball memorabilia.
I'm feeling like they're displaying it somewhere. So it looks like it has some value to me. So I will say, and maybe I shouldn't say this because it's giving you clues. I will say $100.
$100 to Kelsey.
$175
to Audrey.
$180
to Kelsey.
$200.
$215.
$225.
$225 to Audrey.
I'll hold.
This is going to make it a lot easier for Kelsey at the end if she can just hold out, drive you up on the next item. She'll get all three of the end ones.
$350, I think.
All right. Okay. Our next item is a presidential bust of Grover Cleveland.
My favorite president. This is going to color my...
Audrey, why is he your favorite president?
He was elected two times, but not consecutively. Couple reasons,
that's
one of them. You also got married in the White House.
Do I have a starting bid of $100 for the bust of Grover Cleveland?
Oh, okay. My favorite.
100 to Audrey.
I don't really think it's worth anything, but I feel bad. I haven't bought anything yet. 150.
150 to Kelsey.
151.
151 to Audrey.
175.
175 to Kelsey. No. Audrey's out on Grover Cleveland.
Looks like Grover president.
So hard.
Grover Cleveland to Kelsey for 175.
I'm getting bad vibes about this purchase. I might regret it.
Our next one is a selection of small cups made from rhinoceros horn.
Whoa.
Ooh. Okay.
$50.
50 for the rhinoceros horn cups to Kelsey.
75.
100.
100 to Kelsey.
She can have them.
All right.
I can
$100
have them?
For Kelsey. Gets the rhinoceros horn cup.
We're going to have to bet big on our last ones. We both have a lot of money left.
Yeah, you guys might have to go big or go home on the next ones. We've got two more items left. Let's see. This one is perhaps a vase or a ceramic receptacle of some sort with some abstract looking faces on it.
It's a porcelain trash can.
$200.
Whoa.
$200 for the face vase.
Face. $300.
$300 to Kelsey for the face vase.
$350.
$400.
$400 to Kelsey for the face vase.
$450.
You're giving her the face vase for $450.
Face vase. It's probably worth $35.
All right. And our final item.
I don't think I have much money, so I'll just say I'll bet all my remaining money.
How much do I have left?
This one is very spot on for our book. It is a donated sculpture.
Mysterious.
So a sculpture that had been sitting in a school for a while that had been donated by an eccentric owner.
Uh-oh. Or a liar.
That is not what I was
like
expecting.
A small, round liar.
Ugh, okay. I don't want this, but I feel like I should buy it.
Kelsey gets the donated sculpture unless she's refusing it on principle.
I'll take it. How much am I buying it for? So I bought it for $205.
$201.
$201. Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to know how much I have left in case I need it to cover.
That might make up the
to help
ground.
Me win. Yeah.
All right. So painting of a rich lady. Audrey paid $125. Its estimated price was $700,000. Okay. The baseball memorabilia. Someone had tried to buy it from her for $5,000. She had it because her family had run a boarding house in which the team had stayed. The estimated value at auction was $1 million. Audrey spent $225 on it. All right. Our bust of Grover Cleveland actually belongs to Mo Rocca. He spent not much different from what you spent, Kelsey. You spent $175. He spent $150. It is worth $200 and was apparently not actually Grover Cleveland.
No, but I profited, yes?
Yes, you did. You came out $25 ahead. The horn cups sold to Kelsey for $100. The appraisal on it was $1 million, but they actually sold for only $182,000 at auction. So you came out with a big profit, but not what?
Darn. So what do I get?
$182,000 and you spent $100 on it. Illegal rhinoceros horn is just
hard to move.
An easy thing to sell these days. The face vase was purchased by the owner for $300. Audrey spent $450 on it. It was initially appraised as a Picasso. It was not a Picasso and ended up being worth about $2,000. It was made by a girl in Oregon for a high school project. And she saw it on the show and was like, wait, I did that.
But also, she got $2,000 for it.
Or well, I guess she did. The guy that bought it did. She didn't get anything
like at a
for
yard
it.
Sale or something, freaked up. Probably.
It just had ended up in garage sales
and yeah,
her
sale.
Parents like got rid of it.
It's got to be good to
it
feel.
It looked nice, but not necessarily.
Yeah, so not a huge profit on that one. All right, the donated sculpture. Kelsey spent $201 on it. It ended up being, I guess, a very excellent example of work by a famous artist, and it sold for $981,000.
I didn't even want it.
All right, so Audrey came out with $1,702,000 worth of gear in the auction. How about you, Kelsey?
I got
All right. And Kelsey came in with $1,163,200. So a profitable day for both ladies.
I'm disappointed.
Audrey did come out ahead.
Add my extra 500 that I have.
True. So that's $1,163,700 for Kelsey.
I will say, I knew those baseball cards are going to be worth a lot. I should have fought harder.
Okay. Each episode, we ask whether our book passes the Bechdel test. The Bechdel test asks whether a work features two female characters who talk to each other about something that doesn't involve men or boys. Now, Claudia does spend a lot of time talking about Michelangelo as the putative sculpture of Angel, but she does talk to Mrs. Frankweiler about herself.
Yeah, I think this is a barely pass one because she's talking with Jamie for most of the book. So none of that counts.
Right.
So it's only when she's talking to Mrs. Frankweiler.
Low pass, but I'm not upset about it.
I'm not either.
It's just the nature of the book.
And the test really is meant for really egregious examples of
it is. Well, and this one's a little weird because it's epistolary. So like technically Mrs. Frankweiler's talking to us the whole time, right?
Yeah, and I'm a girl.
And I'm a girl. And she's narrating a story that involves a girl. To us.
That's it for this episode of These Books Made Me. Join us next time when we'll discuss a book in which a girl's mom sews through her tears. If you think you know which book we're tackling next, drop us a tweet. We're @PGCMLS on Twitter and #ThesebooksMadeMe.